From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, our newest book song, where we create a unique, one-of-a-kind song just for your book, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo, and my guest today is very fascinating, Henry J. Evans. Title of the book, Bombs, Bacon, and Bankruptcy, The Art of Crisis Leadership. He is the founder and CEO of Dynamic Results, a strategy and culture transformation firm that helps organizations thrive by unleashing the superpowers of their people. He is the author of the bestseller, Winning with Accountability, The Secret Language of High-Performing Organizations, and co-author of Step Up, Lead in 6 Moments That Matter. His books have been adopted by many organizations, and he has personally delivered more than 16,000 plus hours of executive coaching to leaders around the world. It's a lot. Welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, Henry.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Oh my gosh, it's all my pleasure. I love the title, Bombs, Bacon, and Bankruptcy. That's going to catch everybody's eye for sure. What a title. Now, you had a background in counterterrorism.
So I was a failing entrepreneur after 9/11, and a client's husband that I knew did some kind of cloak and dagger stuff contacted me and asked me if I would go to an Air Force base and help his team think about a problem for a couple of weeks, to which I replied, I'm not qualified. I'm a college dropout whose company just failed. And he leaned in a moment we both remember and said, I decide who's qualified. And told me that they would pay me for 2 weeks, that we'd be working in acronyms. I would be escorted because I didn't have a clearance. And that if I was right and I didn't add value, I would get paid for 2 weeks and we would still be friends. And if he was right and I did add value, I added something to their team, he might ask me to get a clearance, which is ultimately what happened. And that began a 22-year journey, not only in counterterrorism, but also on other geopolitical threats.
Oh my, what a story. This is inspiration for everybody. Actually, you never know where you're going to land, do you?
No, in fact, his superpower, as I learned over time, he was not psychic. He was just capable of seeing what other people's superpowers are and how to combine them into the right team. And that is one of the skills you need that I wrote about in the book when you're leading through crisis or disruption.
I loved when I mentioned that you help organizations thrive by unleashing the superpowers of their people. And so that kind of explains that puts that little phrase into perspective. So how did your book come about? Give us a peek into why, and then maybe a little peek into what the book is about.
Sure. So I had stepped out of the counterterrorism work for the first time in 2015, and then I was asked to return to it, which I did. And I was being offered another mission in 2024. And when I saw who I was assigned to, it was somebody that I'd worked with in the past. And not even saying that I was right and she was wrong or vice versa, we just tended not to see things the same. And I requested a meeting and she told me her approach to the mission. And I said, I don't think I'll make a good member of your team because I would take an almost orthogonal approach. And she was pretty aggressive and said, well, you'll do what I tell you to because you're working for me. And I reminded her that I was a government contractor, not a government employee. And she said I had 2 weeks to give her my answer. So she got my answer during that call. And I said, I'm out. So I was working with a colleague on a new keynote to kind of talk about crisis leadership, because you do, when you're in actual life and death mission work, you learn a lot about what to do and what not to. And I thought that might be a benefit to other people, not just in business, but maybe if they're going through a health crisis or a job loss. So I mentioned it to a colleague and she said, well, that's not a keynote, that's a book. And I told her she was wrong. And then my original publisher contacted me unrelated. He said the same thing. And it wasn't until our actual publisher said, this is a book, that I believed it. So I'm not that smart, but I'm surrounded by smart people. That's how the book came about, I needed three people to tell me that it was a book.
Oh my, this gets even more fascinating. Let's talk about these major case studies. Terrorism, which is the bombs aspect, the pandemic, which is the bacon aspect, and a succession crisis, bankruptcy. What connects these seemingly different crises?
The human limbic system. So we have the same response to a real or a perceived crisis. So an example I give is, if you're in an actual life and death situation, your limbic system reacts in a certain way. And if you're watching a drama on Netflix and you care about the characters, what I call the Ferrari side of your brain, the fast emotional side of your brain, believes what you're seeing and hearing is real. And that's why you care. The bicycle or rational side of your brain may not be present in those moments. And it doesn't matter if you're in an actual crisis or a perceived one, you're going to get hijacked by your Ferrari brain. And we need to get the bicycle brain in motion so you can bring objective thinking to the situation at a pace that is faster than the crisis is moving.
Hmm. And that reminds me of in the book where you discuss the amygdala hijack and its impact on decision making. So thinking about that, what steps can people, leaders take to regain their objectivity in the heat of a crisis?
I wrote a number of techniques in the book, but let's talk about one of them that special operators use on a mission, because even your tier one, tier two operators who are going on top secret missions are Homo sapiens with a limbic system, and they get nervous too. So there are hacks to hack your limbic system. So one of the hacks that these special operators use is called box breathing. So think about 4 4-second counts. So you inhale for 4 seconds, you hold that inhale for 4 seconds, you exhale for 4 seconds, and then you hold your empty lungs for 4 seconds, and you just repeat this 2 or 3 times. And this will stop the production of adrenaline and cortisol. It'll put blood back into the prefrontal cortex where you do your bicycle thinking, your intelligent, objective thinking, and it has you more mission ready for whatever you're facing. Be that, as I said, a business crisis, a family crisis, loss of a loved one, health crisis, anything that gets you off center and destabilizes you.
Interesting. Box breathing. So what we're talking about here and your book, it's not just for leadership management. I mean, everyday people can take these concepts and use them to improve their daily life. Is that true?
That was absolutely my intention when I wrote it. And I wrote in the book and I say in keynotes that, you know, you're probably not going to be asked in your lifetime to do a raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. That's not the average day for the average person. But we all receive news or find ourselves in situations where we get emotionally hijacked, we feel off center. And most people, they've been trained in certain things like driving or cooking or medicine, but they're not trained in crisis leadership. And there are concrete proven tools and systems for how to prioritize, delegate, make decisions when information is missing in a way that increases your likelihood of success.
You know, as we're talking here, I'm thinking, are some people better equipped just naturally or just have an innate ability to react or conduct themselves during a crisis versus others?
So I've got industrial psychologists on my team in the firm, but I, as I mentioned, I'm a college dropout, so I'm not clinically qualified to answer that. I can answer it through my experience.
Yes, yeah.
Working with C-suite executives and people in that arena. I think the answer is yes, but there's still a bell curve. So if you're not on the highest, strongest end of the crisis leadership bell curve, that doesn't mean you can't learn to be better than you are today. Mm-hmm. And also, some of the people on that highest end, unfortunately, fall into the realm of sociopathy. So these are people who don't care about feelings, including their own. And that might make them effective in a crisis. It probably doesn't make them effective as a boss or a significant other or a parent.
That's fascinating. I wouldn't have thought of the tie to sociopathy, but that makes sense. Now, your book opens with the idea that every crisis is unique and constantly shifting. How do you recommend that leaders prepare for this unpredictability?
So one of the things I'm trying to convey to the reader, and to be clear, the book is not about me or about what I did. It opens speaking to the reader, it closes speaking to the reader, and it's meant to equip everyone who reads it to be better at crisis leadership. So the best way to prepare for a crisis is to prepare when you're not in crisis. Mm-hmm. So I want you to think about it as resiliency, as a set of skills you practice so that when they're needed, you can use them. I think I was saying to a group of leaders last week that you don't want to learn CPR while you're watching someone drown.
Right.
You want to already be CPR certified before that happens. So it's not just the hardcore tools and processes for prioritizing decision making and delegation, but it's also building the relationships and trust out of crisis so that you don't have to deal with people's feelings as much during crisis. So if you know, I've always supported you as a colleague, I've always offered you resources when you needed them, I've given you a shoulder to cry on, I've listened to you attentively when we're not in crisis, you know I care about you when we're in the crisis. And if you start talking about your feelings, I can say I really care about your feelings and I think you know that. We don't have time to talk about them right now. We need to take some action. And you'll go with me because we built that trust out of crisis. You also will be familiar with these tools and processes, so you'll trust that they're going to get us through.
Interesting. Wow. You're talking about preparing before a crisis, and then that takes me to the section of your book, the Bacon case study, and how all of us were so unprepared for anything like that, even simple things like, you know, stocking up on water or simple prep foods, those type of things that we never really thought about before, and hopefully we do now. So that case study focuses on a supermarket chain during COVID-19. What did this business crisis teach you about balancing, let's say, short-term survival with long-term strategy?
That is such a great question, because when we're doing our strategy consulting, we don't take a client who only wants to accomplish something short-term without thinking about their long-term future. And we don't do the opposite either. You should be optimizing your life today and preparing for an optimized life tomorrow. So what happened during that crisis was the president contacted me. We were 3 months into a 2-year strategy execution engagement. And he said, well, naturally, we have to pause our work with you and your firm because we have to manage this crisis. Now, I could not tell him about the other work I did in counterterrorism or national security issues, but I was able to convince him and his board that our team knew how to manage a crisis and we could help them manage the pandemic in a way that helped the business operate during the apex of the crisis while we continued to execute on their strategic objectives that were future shaping. So I learned that positioned properly, leaders can make very bold and courageous moves. I think 9 out of 10 leaders would have made the call that he made to pause the work, but only 2 or 3 out of 10 leaders would have had the courage he and his team had to trust us and continue doing both, securing the present and the future.
Wow. Goodness. And so what about the bankruptcy story? It's about succession crisis. Maybe explain succession crisis. But in this particular case, it ended in failure. Interesting that you thought it was important to include a story where things didn't work out.
You know, I had to be advised on that too. So I was mostly protective of this story because I still care about the person who is the principal in the story. And I felt that telling the story would somehow make her look bad. And I had one colleague, she's been with me for 30 years across 5 companies. She said, Henry, you don't make her look bad at all. You're actually helping the reader understand what not to do. And you are very empathic about explaining her role. So Bombs was about, I know you asked about Bacon and bankruptcy, but they do follow a sequential logic.
Okay.
So bombs is about what we thought would be a 2-year counterterrorism mission that actually took 8 years, and that was to eradicate roadside bombs or IEDs. That was a success story and a roller coaster. So that's in that counterterrorism arena. Then in the business arena, which is more relatable to most people, Bacon was about a multi-billion dollar company with tens of thousands of employees serving millions of customers, figuring out how to secure their present and their future. And those are two success stories. We felt it was important to also write about a failure. And in this instance, we had a founder who, in a really tragic way, I mean, he drowned in front of his daughter, passed suddenly. And the wife, who I knew, who had a school teaching background, decided to heroically step in and try to run this manufacturing company. And along with her friends and family, when she asked me to help her, I said, look, you're in trauma and your daughters are in trauma and you're no more qualified to run a manufacturing company than I am to go teach one of your classes in a school. So let me hire an interim CEO. Let me get the company ready for sale while you recover in trauma, and we'll sell the company. That preserves your ex-husband's legacy. It takes care of you and your daughters, and you can focus on what matters most. And to make a long story short, she decided to forge ahead. And again, she was in trauma. So the Ferrari side of her brain took over, and she emotionally wanted to preserve her husband's legacy. In hindsight, she's told me, now that the bicycle side of her brain is working, she wishes she had listened, because in the end, the company went bankrupt and everyone lost their jobs. And so there's a lesson in objective thinking in that story. There's a lesson in humility. And it was definitely humbling for me, because I saw the way to help, but I was never able to successfully convey it in a way that engaged her. And that led to us failing.
We're talking about decision-making. She refused the consultative decision-making aspect of it and just made these decisions kind of on her own. I would think that that made a critical difference in the outcome.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of crisis response, especially in business, is basic arithmetic, right? So if their sales dropped suddenly and there was no option other than to liquidate some inventory and do a reduction in staff, an empath, and I score high in empathy, is going to say, well, we can't let anybody go because they've been so loyal to us and they're doing such a great job. Mm-hmm. A purely objective thinker will say, well, wait, everyone's going to lose their job if we don't make these reductions. So yes, we're going to do a job reduction, but we're also securing and preserving the sustainability of most jobs. So she would agree with the math when we would show her what we had to do to create more runway economically. And then she would go to talk to staff and they would say, wait a second, I've worked here 20 years. You know my kids. Yeah. If you let me go, it's going to devastate our family. And she would come back and say, we can't let these people go. And it was her empathy and her being in trauma that led to her refusing to execute on some pretty simple math. And when I say simple math, I just mean objectively, emotionally, these decisions are terrible. I've had to make them myself, and they're traumatic when you're letting people go that haven't done anything wrong. But sometimes you have to do that in business.
That's a rough call, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah. Well, I guess at the end of the day, I hope she felt okay with herself that she made the right decision, you know, maybe not for her business, but for her personally.
Yeah, I think she made decisions that she feels emotionally proud of. In hindsight, you can't argue that they were not sound economically. And that's what we mean by, I call it speed to objectivity in the book. A crisis has a momentum. So think about if you got bad health news. There's a momentum to whatever the illness or condition you're struggling with has. And the medical treatment you receive, if it's successful, if it's a cancer and it's growing, the treatment should be slowing down or reducing or even stopping that growth. So if you don't have objective thinking, you're going to perhaps be running as fast or faster than the crisis, but you won't be making your most intelligent decisions, and you could actually make the crisis worse.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean when you talk about fail fast and learn faster?
Yeah, the reason why we advise our clients to execute strategy in 90-day sprints and not in five-year plans is that look at life. I mean, every time we think we have a perfect plan, or most times we think we have a perfect plan, life educates us and teaches us that we were wrong. Life happens. Changes happen. Disruptions happen. And the rate of disruption, we'll go back to business, is increasing almost exponentially across different industries. So your agility and resilience has to also be increasing. You have to be able to make a plan, but then abandon it or aspects of it when you're receiving data telling you that it isn't working. So you have to be almost egoless as you navigate a crisis. And I'll say something that has upset some of the men in my life, but men are not as good at operating without ego as women, generally speaking. And most organizations are run by men. Mm-hmm. So if that man hasn't done work on himself, if the leader, male or female, hasn't developed themselves to be able to let go of their own idea and go with somebody else's idea, if it's more appropriate or more informed, they're leading the organization to an unsuccessful outcome.
That makes me think about the people's ability to communicate. Some people just have the ability to communicate. I'm assuming that's something that can be learned. But in your experience, what are the most common mistakes leaders make during a crisis with their communication skills, and how can they avoid that?
So the general principles of change management communication do apply in a crisis. They just have to be executed more abruptly. So there, first of all, it's repetition. So you have to make sure that a message is clear, concise, repeated, but also repeatable. It should be memorable so that those people can then go to their people and communicate the message consistently. I think a big mistake leaders make is assumption. They assume that their team should already know what they're thinking or mm-hmm. should already know what to do. And assumption is not good for us out of crisis. It can be deadly in crisis. So clear, repeated, repeatable communication is critical. I think a mistake that leaders with ego make in crisis is they assume because they've survived other types of crisis in their past, that they're equipped to manage the current crisis. But if the current crisis is truly disruptive, it means that their past experience is not applicable in the current situation. And that's a hard pill for many people to swallow, that, hey, I've navigated five things in life, five really dramatic events. But to recognize I'm not qualified for the current one, again, requires you to be egoless and open to new data.
Wow, so much here, so much. This is fascinating. Earlier, you kind of alluded to emotional safety, where you were talking about the friend, where you had the disagreement, and you said, you know that you and I have this relationship or that I care about you, but we don't have time to talk about that now. Let's just talk about what's at hand. Let's talk about the importance of emotional safety in teams, because I think that could kind of smooth the way for even somebody who doesn't communicate well, if they know that the person leading actually cares about them. So maybe explain a little bit about what emotional safety means and how leaders can foster it, especially during a crisis or under pressure.
I'm smiling when you say the word foster, because my co-author, when we published the emotional safety concept in 2014, is Dr. Colm Foster. And Colm had done 5 years of PhD research embedding himself in high-performing organizations. And his goal was to study what high-performing leaders do and what high-performing organizations do. And I really admire his intellect, because he didn't limit himself to companies. He thought whoever's got a best-in-class reputation. So he studied the Jesuit Order, U.S. Marines, Royal Marines, any organization that just had that best-in-class reputation. And he found that those people, those leaders, had certain superpowers. One of them answers your question, and it's attacking ideas or behaviors, not people. So I want you to imagine that I said something you didn't like. I said something triggering. Maybe I vote for the other candidate. And you think, what's wrong with you, Henry? How could you possibly vote for the other candidate? If you had that type of reaction, like, what are you, stupid? And you may not say that out loud, but if I can see it on your face, that's how you're viewing me, you've taken me as a holistic human being and thrown me out into the trash because I have an opinion that does not align with yours. If you're more sophisticated than that and you can attack my opinion without attacking me, you can actually build our relationship while disagreeing with me. And what that sounds like is saying something like, wow, Henry, I know we both want a better country, and I usually agree with you on most things, but tell me more about why you think your candidate is better than mine. I cannot understand it. Mm-hmm. And now, and you can bring the heat, you can bring some weather when you do that, but I don't feel personally attacked. I feel like you're challenging my idea, and then I'm still going to want to go have dinner with you afterwards. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And especially during these times, this is invaluable. We may not have had this kind of situation 10, 20 years ago, but now people judge and decide if they like you, if they're going to spend time with you, if they want to work with you based on, as you say, who they might favor politically. And that's just insanity.
And I wrote about that implicitly in the opening of the book, that I did the counterterrorism and national security work under four presidential administrations that were very, very different. Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden. And what I wrote about is that we really didn't care who was in the White House because we had a shared motto, and that was give the bad guys a bad day every day. Ah. So when we would talk about the administration that was in office, it would be in an extremely objective way. I never heard a partisan word spoken behind the fence, as we would say. So we would say, okay, if we want to run a mission in that part of the world, how does the current administration support or oppose activity in that country? But it wasn't this guy's a loser or this guy's a hero. And I think the division, it's not just in the US, but in most of the West now, politically, is caused by people forgetting that we have a lot of common interests and we have a lot of points of agreement. And we're being manipulated to focus on only what we disagree on through algorithms. Yes. And we have to be smarter than these social media entities and apps that are trying to cause the division to monetize it. And I'm hoping that readers find more balance looking at this, because if there is a threat to the house we live in, that threat is to all of us.
Yes. Yes, you are fascinating. I love this. I could spend the day with you here. This is so rich. There's so much to talk about and know. Oh my gosh. So now the book is coming out in November. Yes, it's not available. Pre-order?
It is, yeah. In fact, we've been quite fortunate and I would say lucky with pre-orders. So people are ordering it, but it'll ship on November 10th.
All right. Well, we're going to begin to kind of wrap up here. Anything we missed that you wanted to highlight?
I would say that there are people in your life, and you might be one of them if you're listening to this podcast, who have what psychologists call a negative bias, meaning their first response is to say that things won't work out. They say things like, we can't do that. That's too hard. This won't work. I call them cave people, citizens against virtually everything. We need those people. So somebody with an optimistic bias like me, who thinks we can conquer any challenge, we can climb any mountain, I'm not going to be capable of seeing the obstacles and roadblocks in my way. So instead of ostracizing those cave people, I actually want a couple of them on my team. Mm-hmm. If you are a cave person, don't try to lead a team through crisis, because nobody wants to be led onto the battlefield being told they're going to die. But if you're an optimist, make sure you balance your optimistic thinking with people who might think more critically or more negatively about situations, so you have a more balanced, holistic approach to the problem. And, you know, we've had a lot of cancer in my family. I would even apply this to oncologists. It's why you get a second opinion. If somebody says you can't overcome something or you have to have a surgery, no one's questioning that that's an expert who's medically qualified to give that advice. But even medicine is subjective, and these assessments are subjective. So try to collect as much data as you can in the time you have before you start to attack your crisis.
Just that little nugget there is invaluable. Yes, I think everybody feels that they're right. It's like, yes, you know, I would say to my husband, let's get rid of that wall and we can put this here. No, you can't do that. And so then you've got that push-pull. Is like, I'm always thinking we can, you're always thinking we can't, but how valuable it is to have that voice on the other side to give you the reasons, to show you why perhaps it isn't. It's a foundation wall. You can't do that. So I think that was really sage advice. Thank you for that. I love this. Bombs, Bacon, and Bankruptcy. Maybe share with us where folks can find out more about you and where they can get copies of this very, very important book.
Thank you. So they can go to henryjevansplural.com. They can order it there, mm-hmm. pre-order it, and they can also learn a lot more, not just about the case studies, but also kind of see the framework for how to attack a crisis.
Oh my gosh, this is a book for everyone. As I mentioned, it's not just leadership. I think every person, you don't have to have a big company. Even a mom or a dad is a leader of their home. And to have these kind of tips and tricks available to them, I think is extremely important.
I've got a friend, and we won't go into it because we're wrapping up, whose family has just had a horrific tragedy occur. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even realize it until after we hung up. He called me first and asked for help. But I was just naturally, organically using the tools in the book in the conversation we were having. And it wasn't cognitive. I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to pull this tool off the shelf and help my friend. It's just a way of thinking in crisis that I've practiced enough times that it comes naturally. And that's what I want everyone to do. I want them to practice what I call a response to crisis, so that they're not reacting in crisis. And I hope that the book does that for people.
Oh, definitely. I can see that it will. And we're talking with Henry J. Evans. The title of the book is Bombs, Bacon, and Bankruptcy, The Art of Crisis Leadership. Website is henryjevans.com. You are fabulous. This is just awesome. I am just thrilled to have met you and can't wait to get a copy and share this book with others.
Well, your energy is contagious. And I felt very motivated speaking with you. So thank you for being such a wonderful host.